My name is Lance Birch. I'm one of the pastors here at Reality, and if you're a first-time guest, welcome. We're so glad you made the choice to be here on this frigid morning. We are on part two of a series called This Is the Year, and we've been talking about the fact that we've got this reset button on life that we call New Year's, and that's really cool because sometimes we look back and we just want to push the reset button that we called grace last week, where we can say, look, I know I messed up, but let's push that reset button. But here's the thing, even though we can push the reset button, it doesn't mean we've got an unlimited supply of time. We're not always going to have a new year. Tom Hiddleston, you may know and recognize his face. He's also Loki on some of the Thor movies. But he has a pretty good quote. Some Loki fans, all right, good. I love this quote. We have two lives. The second one starts when we realize we only have one. Isn't that cool? And I think that's why we're saying this is the year. Because we know that we've got a limited time on the planet. Life's like an hourglass glued to the table. And we know that we're not guaranteed that we're going to get some more time. And also we're saying this is the year because we know that 1 year can change everything. 1 year in a life can change everything. You don't have to be the same person next year that you are right now. Everything can change. God can heal something. He can redeem something. He can even resurrect something. But as we look at that truth, we also are confronted by what's really going on in our culture. And that song here is one of those songs that just kind of I listen to over and over again. It just is haunting to me that some people feel stuck. Like culture is moving them and they're kind of moving along with what's going on in culture, and there they are just stuck here and they can't seem to get from here to there, maybe even where God wants them to be. And that's pretty haunting to me. I want to show you a picture. This is the Choluteca Bridge in Honduras. All right, take a look at that picture. All right, what seems to be wrong in that picture? As you look at it, you go, well, it looks like a fine bridge. I mean, it looks like they spent a lot of money on it. It looks like the engineers and everybody did a really good job on this bridge. This is not Photoshopped, okay? So that's where you're going. This is a very real bridge and a very real river. And so the people on the other side of the river can't cross. Why is that? Is it because there's not a good bridge? No, it's a fine bridge. In fact, you might think, you know, who are the engineers who built this bridge? They were very smart people. Japanese engineers came on down to Honduras. They drew up the drawings. They built the bridge. They spent a lot of money on it, and it was a very successful bridge. In fact, it was so successful that it was designed to withstand hurricane force winds. It was one of the only bridges in Honduras which could do that. When Hurricane Mitch came in 1998, it dumped, get this, 75 inches of rain in less than 4 days. And it destroyed 150 Honduran bridges, but not the Choluteca Bridge. But what happened? Is this just a bunch of dumb people who couldn't figure out what was going on and they built that bridge right there? No, the hurricane force was so strong that it carved out a new river basin and the river moved. The river moved. So a perfectly good bridge, a good idea built by good people, is completely and totally useless now. And you know, it will withstand every hurricane that blows through, but it's not going to move people from one side to the other, from here to there. And so we're looking at this year, how can we look at that picture and say, are there some new bridges that we need to build as a church? Maybe some things that used to work, they were good ideas thought up by smart people, but the culture has raged with such fury that the river has actually moved. And guys, we can get mad at the river. I'm sure, you know, those engineers would love for that river to move back. You can get mad at the river, you can shout at it, you say, you should be over here. Don't you guys understand that we spent a lot of money on this and this is what you've got to conform to our bridge. But culture's not going to conform to our bridge, and the river's never going to move back. And here's where we came to. Our kids, guys, our church's kids, and this community's kids, and this nation's kids, and globally, our children are finding themselves over here, and they can't get over to here on the old bridges that we've built. And that's what kind of what we're talking about. And it's important. What we're talking about today is probably the most important thing we're going to say. If our kids find themselves, like in that song, stuck over here, and we can shout at them, and we can get mad at them, and we can say, you know, when I was a kid, we did it this way. But guess what? The river is not going to move. Culture has moved with such fury that the river's not underneath the bridge anymore, and it's not going to go back under. It's important because of this. Some people, how many of you guys have ever heard the quote, the church is always one generation away from disappearing? Any of you guys ever heard that quote? I don't know that that's true because Jesus said that the church is going to endure forever. But I know that this is true. I think this is true. Faithfulness is always one generation away from disappearing. In other words, people who are living for God, who are making God their only hope, we're always one generation away. That gets passed down from father to son, from mother to daughter, from parents to their kids, from ministries to the people that they're discipling. All of that stuff is very tenuous, and we're one generation away from a group of people who know nothing about bringing God glory or placing their hope in God when there's a whole other buffet of things they can put their hope in. And here's what we're saying as a church. We're looking at the way maybe the American church has done children's ministry and student ministry, and we're saying maybe that's an old bridge. Maybe that doesn't work anymore. And it's not because dumb people built it. It's not because they didn't think ahead. It's not because they didn't, you know, really work hard on it. It's actually, it worked. Smart people built it. It was well built. It served its purpose. But now the river's moved. Things have changed. The things that used to work maybe don't work anymore. And we need to keep the same truth, but maybe build a new bridge. In other words, keep to the old paths, keep to the old roads, but build a new bridge. Now, the old bridge of the church and even of families was to outsource your kids' spiritual maturity to the church. It's like, I don't know much about the Bible. I don't know much about God, but I can go to church. We got kids now. I think it's time we go back to church. And you sign them in and you say, okay, now go and make them look like Jesus. You guys make them look like Jesus. And then we'll pick them up after an hour and you guys have transformed them into little Jesuses and we'll take them home and they'll help with the dishes and they'll clean up their room and all that. So thank you, church. That's great. So outsourcing your kids' spiritual development to the church, I think, you know, as weird as this might sound, worked at one time. That there was a generation that kind of drank in those truths, that the truth that there was a God, that God cared about them, was kind of, it permeated our society and all the kids, you know, they believed it and maybe it worked. But culture now has moved with such force that the river moved and the kids, our kids find themselves on the other side and we can shout at them and we get mad at them, but they're going to stay over there. Part of the old bridge for us was, at least in the American church, was the idea of Sunday school. One teacher standing in front of the class, telling the kids a Bible story, maybe in a really compelling way, but one teacher, large group, tell the truth, and then the kids, you know, maybe listen, and then they go home and they apply that to our lives. Now, I did 23 years of student ministry. And I loved it. And a lot of what we did in student ministry at the time was an incredible band and then the, you know, light show. And then I would get up and I would talk to them and they would, you know, hopefully they would take notes or something and remember some of this stuff. And then they'd go home. Large group studies, large events. And guys, hey, it worked. I saw people in that environment apply the truth of God's word and they go home and it changes them. But I don't think it works anymore. I think our cultural river has moved, and kids are now facing incredible distractions. They're facing an antagonistic world when it comes to whether there is even a God, and they are facing things that maybe were bigger than what I faced when I was a teenager, and maybe bigger than even the kids of 4 or 5 years ago. Student ministry and children's ministry changes just about every 5 years. So we need to find a way to keep the old roads, to keep the old truth, and maybe build a new bridge. And this is not new. The church has always been one generation away from losing faithfulness. This is something that's covered actually in the Bible in multiple places. We've talked before about Deuteronomy 6, where the whole nation of Israel gets together and it's told to them, look, guys, we've got kids. Now what are we going to do? We've got this whole next generation. We've got this whole new generation coming up. What are we going to do with them? And then the text says, talk about it. Tell the story of God. When you're lying down, when you're waking up, when you're eating, when you're walking, you know, down the path, talk about these stories and instill them into the minds of the next generation, because we're one generation away. Today we're going to look at a scripture in Psalm 78. Psalm 78 is this epic kind of poem where the psalmist, the poetry writer, it was actually, these were sung out loud, so this was a song. He's warning Israel and he's saying, guys, we've messed up. And we've messed up time after time after time. We just keep on, like, you know, there's a great proverb that says, like a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool to his folly. That's in there. That's in the Bible. Look that one up. And the psalmist in Psalm 78 is saying, we just keep on doing the same thing. God shows up, we ignore him. God gives us a second chance, we take advantage of him instead of the second chance. So it's a warning, but we're just going to look at the first 8 verses. And the first 3 verses are basically old roads. He's saying, look, we've got this chance to impact the next generation. So let's look back. Let's take a moment, all of us, and look back. What has God done in our lives? What has God done in the nation of Israel? You guys know some of the things that God did. God rescued them. He named Abraham, and he said, I'm going to bless the whole world through you. And he gave him some sons. He gave him Isaac, and then Isaac had Jacob, and then Jacob, Joseph, moved them all to Egypt. A few generations happened, and then God rescued them from slavery with Moses, brought them to the promised land. Joshua moves in. They take over the promised land. They've got some judges. Then they've got some kings. God has done amazing things. Time after time, he's come through for them, even when they ignored him. Kind of like our life, right? I mean, do you have a stellar, you know, like 4.0 when it comes to spiritual walk with God? Or has God rescued you on more than one occasion? So the psalmist here, the poetry writer, is saying, look back. Look back to the old road. Look back at what's happened. And don't just keep it a secret. Tell the next generation. We will not hide them, he says in verse 4. We will not hide them from their children, but we will tell the coming generation the praises of the Lord. The implication here is that if you don't tell the next generation, you're not just being passive, you're being active because you're hiding the truth. You're hiding how good God is. You're hiding how awesome God is if you don't tell your kids and even get involved in next generation ministries. We will not hide them from their children, but we will tell the coming generation. Tell them what? The praises of the Lord. The praises of the Lord, his strength, his wonderful works that he's done. I love, you know, talking to my own kids and just say, you know, how awesome is God? Well, I remember when I was driving around, my dad brought an RV and we would travel around. We saw Grand Canyon. We vacationed together a lot, and I love those trips. But my dad was the kind of guy, even when we weren't on vacation, to pull over the car on the side of the road and say, kids, look at the sunset. You know, how awesome is God? How awesome is this? And as a kid, honestly, you remember being a kid. I was like, oh, whatever. You know, we were headed to McDonald's until now. But it was that moment of just the praises of the Lord. How awesome is God? How often does that come out of your mouth? Would it feel unnatural if you said, man, this is what an incredible gift that God gave us? And it's over and over again, the Bible reminds us that our kids aren't going to know where it comes from unless we tell them. They're going to think it comes from somewhere else unless we tell them. And if we don't tell them, you know what we're doing? We're hiding the glory of God. We're the ones closing the door on the glory of God. We're the ones hiding how awesome God is from our own kids. For God established a rule in Jacob, and he appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers. Notice that says fathers. There's a role for you, dads, that they should make them known to their children. You can't be passive on this. We can't go passive on this because we're always one generation away. We can live for a lot of different things, but God wants the kids to know. God wants the kids to know what? He wants them to know how awesome he is. And here's what might hold us back, dads. Because in order for us to show our kids how awesome God is, we almost, and I think we do, have to reveal how unawesome we are. And maybe we like playing the hero role. I don't know. But when we show our kids how awesome God is, we lose something in light of that. We're not as awesome as maybe they even think we are. It's all about God. And when we put him on display, then we're no longer on display. And we're not the center maybe of their life. But God wants the kids to know. And in order for them to know how awesome God is, the previous generations were going to have to tell the stories that show how unawesome we are. Because you guys might have mistakes in your past. I don't know whether you, I mean, I don't. But I was wondering maybe if you did. Things that you regret, things that show how awesome God is and how awesome his grace is and how unawesome I am. And I know unawesome is not a word, in case that's really getting to you. Why should we do that? That sounds painful. That sounds like something I don't want to do. Well, that the generation to come might know the stories, even the children who are not yet born. Side note here, the Bible calls people that are not yet born, children, just for the record, calls them children, who will arise and declare them to their children. Talking generation after generation after generation of people leading other people to the same truth, the old path that they walked, taking it back to their children, the children's children, the children's children's children. If we do this right, it takes on a life of its own. If we do it right, it becomes this flywheel where the next generation hears it because the other generation wasn't embarrassed to put their own flaws and mistakes on display so that God could be known for who he is. The Bible holds no punches when it tells the stories, does it? It talks about everybody and shows all of their, you know, Abraham, warts and all, we get to read the whole thing. David, the man after God's own heart, also an adulterer and a murderer. You know, it's like God doesn't hide anything. Why? Because the Bible is not about heroes. It's about the hero, God himself alone. And it all points to Jesus. And every time we show, this is who I really am, with authenticity and honesty, we put God on display for who he really is. So why? What's the end game? The end game is this, and this is something we want for ourselves, and something we want for our kids, that they might set their hope in God, that they might set their hope, the thing that they think is going to make their life awesome. I just walked into the dark, but I wanted to talk to you guys too, because, you know, because I've heard about you guys, frankly. that they might set their hope in God. You know, there's tons of things that kids might set their hope in. All kinds of things. They might set their hope in the American dream, which most kids know by rote by now if they've been raised by American parents. You know, you need to study hard. You need to get good grades. You need to eventually get a scholarship so you can go to the right college, maybe meet the right person, get married and have some kids, then buy a minivan, get yourself a 30-year mortgage, and then bring the grandkids home and then, you know, hold your grandkids and then die. And then that's it. The game over. You win. And that's the American dream. And every kid knows it. Why do they know that dream more than they know anything about making a life of impact? You know, I've had kids who went home, told their parents, hey, I think God is calling me to the mission field, and their parents tried to talk them out of it. Why? Because the hope that was placed was in the American dream. It had nothing to do with making an impact. It had nothing to do with the fact that God was awesome. You know, we feel like this life is ours. Drink it up. No, life is a gift. Pour it out. You know, that they might set their hope in God and nothing else. That might sound crazy, yes, but is that practical? I don't know. I mean, is God practical? Is he reality or is something else reality? That they might set their hope in God alone. That's our goal. I hope it is. But we might be steering them to another hope. Some people might hope in technology. Technology is getting so awesome now. I mean, it's just like, you know, 2020, I read an article, the robots are going to attack in 2020, so get ready for that. But right now, technology is awesome. You can, I'm not ever going to have my license taken away. That's awesome. My kids are never going to take away my keys because I'm just going to push a button and my car is going to drive to the grandkids' house. That's awesome. And, you know, I hope I make it there. because that would be a horrible Christmas day if I'm not alive when I get there. Grandpa's here for Christmas. Oh no, that's a horrible thought. I'm sorry I put that in your head. What a horrible Christmas that would be. So hopefully they'll have biometrics on me and take me to the hospital. That they might set their hope in God. Let's just forget all that. People start developing hope, crazy hope, in the unrealistic expectations that media puts out there in social media. This fame culture that children and students have, and they just, I'm going to be famous for doing nothing. And here's the sad part is, you can do that in America. You can get famous for doing absolutely nothing. We can put our hope in a lot of different things. But what about the one hope that we all really have? That we're completely flawed, that we're so much worse than we think we are, and we're more deeply loved than we could ever hope or imagine. That's hope. I'm worse than I could ever think, and I'm more deeply loved than I could ever hope. That's the hope that we want our kids to discover. Because those little G gods that they end up hoping in, whether it's the American dream or technology or relationships or approval or whatever it is, they're going to eventually disappoint. So how do you get them there? From here to there. I think that we need to change the bridge. I think if we're going to lead a child or a student to have their hope in God, we have got to lead in a different way. We've got to lead small. And so here at Reality Church, we intend, and we already have, a relational-based ministry that's dialogue instead of monologue. In other words, not just someone standing in front of them, giving them propositional truths, telling them this is true, now align your life to this. No, we've got people who sit down, same level, look them in the eye and say, this is what I found. Follow me along the old road. I'm a disciple and I'm wanting to disciple you. That means I'm going to teach you how to be an apprentice to Jesus, but I'm an apprentice to Jesus first. Let's talk about this. The day has passed when we can just sit and regurgitate information to a group of kids and expect them to drink it in. There's too much opposition. This needs to be less monologue and more dialogue that they might set their hope in God. And if we do it that way, they're not going to forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. Because, as the previous generation learns, you really don't break God's laws, do you? I mean, I used to think that, man, I broke some commandments. No, I got broken on them. God's laws are just there. It's like gravity. You don't break the law of gravity, but if you jump off your roof, you get broken on the law of gravity, right? The law is there. And so we remind our kids, look, it's not to kill your fun. It's to protect you. Don't forget the works of God. Don't forget His commandments. Don't forget what He said. Even though I got broken on these things, in fact, learn from me. Because experience is not the best teacher. Someone else's experience is the best teacher. So sit down and dialogue with them. And I know why we don't want to do it, because we have to admit where we're not so awesome. And here's the kicker. The reason we want them to set their hope in God, we want them to not forget the commandments, we want them to remember the works of God, is so they won't be like us. And they might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set their heart steadfast and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Now, that's the story of Israel. It doesn't have to be your story, but I bet you've got times in your life that if you could go back, you would say, man, I wish I could press the reset button on that thing. I wish I could do that a little bit differently. I've often wondered why the culture expects so little from children and teenagers. Because I get this all the time when it comes to some sort of moral issue. I hear somebody in the crowd always say, well, they're going to do it anyway. So let's make sure they're safe while they do it. You know, and when you fill in the blank with whatever that is, there's multiple things. They're going to do it anyway. By the way, we never say that probably about driving the wrong way down a one-way street. Well, they're going to do it anyway, so let's give them really bright headlights. We don't say that. But we do say it about a ton of stuff. And here's why I think we say it. Because we're thinking of ourselves. We're actually looking back in our own lives, and I think we're saying, what we're really saying in essence is, I did it anyway. And we don't expect any more of them. That's why we set the bar so low, because we have our own history. How arrogant is it to think that we're the best generation ever and that no one's ever going to surpass our own morality? That's kind of arrogant. What if God can change a heart and change a life? And our kids can rise up and do things differently. Listen, at Reality Church, we don't expect failure from the next generation, from the new generation. We don't. And we're going to raise the bar. And we're going to say, look, if God asks you to do this, God can enable you to do this. And here's where I tripped up and I fell. Maybe you can, through me telling you about this, instead of hiding it from you, maybe you can jump over that. Maybe God can help you get around that. So that they might be faithful to God in the way that we weren't faithful to God. You know, this verse sort of sounds like a condemnation, doesn't it? That they won't be like you, stubborn and rebellious people. But it's also, if you look at it, it's also a really hope-filled message that things can turn around. It doesn't always have to be that same way. Your kids, the next generation, can be different than what we've done. And that's what we're investing here at Reality Church, through this new bridge. Now, the old bridge of the church and families was to outsource the spiritual development of their child to the church, kind of cross their fingers and hope that we're going to get a little Jesus back after this hour. It was a good bridge, but the river moved. So let's build a new one. And we've been building a new bridge here at Reality Church. We're learning how that bridge looks here at Reality. And here's some of what we're going to build it around. Remember, we're sticking to the old roads, but here's some of what we're going to build it around. These are the old roads. Number one, it's a word that we don't say very much. Hang on, I need to read this verse first. Stop at the crossroads, and this is where a lot of people find themselves, a lot of students and children find themselves, at the crossroads, and look around. Ask for the old godly way and walk in it. Travel its path, and you'll find rest for your souls. Our children, our students are standing at a crossroads of life. In fact, probably they're going to come up on a few crossroads. And what we want them to do, what our children's ministry, Reality Kids, and all of our student ministries want them to do is to stop, pause, look around, and ask for the old roads. And hopefully one of those people is going to be there for them, a small group leader or a volunteer, to help augment what you're doing at home. Ask for the old godly way. And here are the old godly ways. Number one, we're going to disciple people. That's a word that we don't hear very much. It might sound foreign to you. You might think the word discipline, but basically it means apprentice, learner, someone who leans into Jesus, a mentor who helps somebody find the old road. And here's why we want to disciple instead of just babysit. Because if kids and student ministry is an 18-year holding tank with snacks and games and pizza, don't be surprised if the next generation doesn't hang around. They're not going to stick around. If, however, they see that the Bible is relevant to their life, we're not making the Bible relevant. The Bible already is relevant to daily life, but we're showing them how. And not just teaching it, but showing them how it's relevant in our own life. That's how you lead small. That's how you make a dialogue. So we disciple them with life on life. Here's how it works for me. And then the next part is, have a home that's a committed Christian home. That doesn't sound like rocket science. It doesn't sound like rocket science. Your family matters when it comes to your child's faith. How much it matters, you might have missed. There was a study done at USC that said that 74% of kids who have parents that are married and together and both of them are committed Christians, 74% of those kids are committed believers as well. How about that stat? That's USC teaching us here today. That seems pretty weird. Parents together make a significant statistical impact on their kids. But recognize that that's a huge part, in fact, the major part of your kids' spiritual development. But also, we need to realize that it takes a church to raise a committed young adult. You need to involve other adults in the discipleship process for your son or your daughter. We do this intuitively in a lot of different ways. Let me turn this thing off. If it was you, then no condemnation because I thought it was me. We do this intuitively in almost every area of our life. I had a girl who wanted to learn how to play piano. I don't know how to play piano, so I hired somebody to help her play piano. That was that part. But you know what? Most of the time was not spent with the person teaching. Most of the time was spent at home. And what was the role of the parent at that point? I'm going to force her to practice because daddy's paying for the lessons, number one. But secondly, because I've got the bulk of the time. And I've got to see whether this is working or not. You as a parent and in your family, you're the laboratory for what's going on at church. Work those things out. Have a committed Christian home and also recognize that it takes a church. This is where student pastors and volunteers and other adults are invested in the lives of your kids. You got a kid that wants to throw a curveball and you don't know how to pitch. You invest. You say, look, can you teach my kid how to throw a curveball? I can't. I partner with me, but I promise you this, I'm going to be throwing with him in the backyard more than you're ever throwing with him. Because you're going to teach him, but I'm going to work it out. I might not know everything about the Bible, but I can take what you give him or her, and we can work it out in real life. That's why we give parent cues that you guys have access to, where you can talk about these things when you're lying down, when you're getting up, when you're eating your meals, and when you're driving down the road. That's called the orange philosophy. You guys might have heard of it. The yellow is provided by the church, the light into their world, and the heart is provided by the parents, and those two come together, and they make orange. And that's a new bridge. That's a new way of thinking about ministry that we're working with, that we're trying to do. And we've also connected that to leading small, a dialogue instead of a monologue, investing relationships. But we've got a problem, and this is kind of funny. In order for us to lead small in our children's ministry, we need more space. I know that sounds weird, but in order for us to lead small effectively, we actually need more space, and our space is effective, but it's not as effective as it could be, and that's why this is the year that we as a church are saying, God, we believe that you're going to enable us to buy this whole building. There's a couple of cool things about that, by the way. This building right here, we're about 19,000 square feet. There's, I think, about 13,000 over there. Do the math in your head. I don't know. I think it's 75,000 square feet. I don't know. it's not exactly that. The cost for the building is $4.3 million. Oh, did I hear a gasp? Let me remind you of something. When we were first Shadow Lake Community Church and we were looking at building out there on the 20 acres, to build a 20,000 square foot building, it was going to cost us upwards of $7 million with the debt that we already had on the land. It was undoable. And now God has delivered us here and has given us almost a 30,000 square, did somebody do the math in their head? Okay, nobody. Close to 30,000, thank you for that. 30,000 square foot building for significantly less. Also, the owners of this building wanted to get a deal done by May, and so we thought, well, if you want to get a deal done by May, close on in May, we sent them an email and said, well, how about you knock $200,000 off the price? And if they had said no, pretty much we would have said, okay, because we're just hard negotiators like that. I mean, that's just kind of we're playing hardball. Guys, they said yes, and we saved the church $200,000 with a proposal like that. God just gave us favor because they didn't have to say any of that. We believe that this is the year that God is going to grant us the ability to purchase that, but not only grant us the ability to purchase that building, but to build out the lower floor, maybe not finishing this year, but finishing out so we can have dedicated high school and junior high space and meeting rooms, and we envision a play set, just kids are sliding down, and when their parents are trying to drag them out of church, they're saying, let's come back tomorrow, and their parents have to break it to them, they're not doing this tomorrow, and they're, well, let's come back when... We see this place teeming with kids because of that. We fully intend and believe that God is going to allow us to get more space so we can lead small. Now, what's your part in this? Well, it's this. Do you buy the vision? I mean, it really comes down to, do we want to make an eternal impact and do we want to impact the next generation? It comes down to vision-driven generosity. We always talk about generosity and say, it's really what we want for you and not from you. We think that God can do this. Do you want to be in on that? Or is your life going to be around something else? Some other vision, some other dream. Vision-driven generosity says, I believe in that vision. I believe we are one generation away from losing our faithfulness as a church, and I'm going to do what it takes to do that. if we get this entire building, just practically, it's going to save. This sounds weird to me. This is just the way economics work. If we buy the whole building, as opposed to renting this part, we save more than $5,000 a month for owning the whole building, rather than just leasing this part. I see, in my mind, I see this coffee shop called Grounded out front. I love Grounded as a name because you're grounded in reality. Okay, you guys are sharp. You're sharp, but you didn't get it. Guys, I can see this place just full of a new generation. And here's what is exciting to me. There are kids who don't even know our name. They don't know you. They don't know us at all. Because of what you do and because of what we do, they're going to move from here to there. From not knowing God, from being lost, from being stuck here, here, here. And we're going to share the gospel with them in a new way. Old path, old road, but a new way. And we're going to see the new generation come to know Christ. I hope you want to be a part of that.